From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we asked journalist Ahmed Rashid, an expert on militant Islam and global terrorism, to assess the threat that Iraq poses, the possibility of a connection between Iraq and al-Qaeda, and the likelihood of war. Rashid has just returned from several weeks in Afghanistan. He covers Afghanistan, Central Asia, and his country, Pakistan, for the Far Eastern Economic Review and the Daily Telegraph of London. His book, Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia, has just come out in paperback. He's also the author of the book Taliban, which became a number one bestseller after September 11th. Ahmed Rashid, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The nation's two top intelligence officials confirmed today that North Korea has a ballistic missile they believe is capable of reaching the western United States, although it hasn't been flight tested. They also backed intelligence assessments that North Korea probably has at least one nuclear weapon. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
When Senator Evan Bayh, an Indiana Democrat, asked CIA Director George Tenet about whether North Korea has a ballistic missile capable of crossing the Pacific and reaching the West Coast, Tenet gave him a direct response.
I think the declassified answer is yes, they can do that.
So in all likelihood, they have nuclear warheads and an ability to deliver them to the West Coast of the United States. Obviously, very, very troubling.
Tenet's assessment of Pyongyang's long-range missile capacity was shared by the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, Vice Admiral Lowell Jacoby, at an open hearing of the Senate Armed Services Committee. Jacoby said the North Korean ballistic missile is still untested and is a three-stage version of the Taepodong 2 missile. Tenet said North Korea likely has one or two nuclear weapons. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
France, Germany, and Belgium have rejected a U.S.-backed compromise that would allow NATO to begin preparing to defend Turkey. The rejection came on the third day of emergency talks aimed to return the alliance to a unified position. With U.S. support, Turkey requested aid from NATO in case of a war in neighboring Iraq. The proposal called for NATO to provide Turkey with surveillance planes, air defense missiles, and troops trained in biological and chemical warfare. The U.S. and 15 other NATO members support the plan, but France, Germany, and Belgium say it's premature to prepare for a possible war, especially when U.S. and UN weapons inspectors are still doing their work. The judge in the case against Zacharias Moussaoui has delayed his trial while the government appeals a sealed court order that would let Moussaoui's lawyers question a key al-Qaeda suspect. NPR's Libby Lewis reports.
The order would let Moussaoui, who is charged with conspiracy in the September 11th attacks, have access to a man in custody who is suspected of masterminding the attacks. Moussaoui's lawyers say that Ramzi bin al-Shib could help Moussaoui's defense. The government has indicated that letting Moussaoui talk to him would compromise national security. Moussaoui, a French citizen of Moroccan descent, has admitted belonging to al-Qaeda, but he says he did not participate in the September 11th attacks. Judge Leana Brinkema did not set a new trial date, but said she would continue to resolve pretrial issues, including issues over the use and admissibility of classified information. Libby Lewis, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks, the Dow lost 85 points to close at 7,758 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The nation's oil supplies are the lowest they've been in 28 years. The Energy Department says that stocks of crude oil are below the level the oil industry considers necessary for its refineries to run smoothly. Analysts say the general strike in Venezuela has reduced supplies at a time when oil markets are worried about the possible impact of a war in Iraq. Oil prices are currently at their highest levels in 2 years. Georgia's new Republican governor has issued a proposal to let voters decide whether they want to put the Confederate battle emblem back on the state flag. Susanna Capilouto reports from Georgia Public Radio.
Governor Sonny Perdue had made a campaign promise that he'd call for a referendum on the state flag. 2 years ago, it was changed from one that predominantly displayed the Confederate battle emblem to one that shows the state seal on a blue background. The move angered Southern heritage groups who campaigned hard for Perdue. The governor says a flag vote will be good for the state.
This process will be a process in which the people of Georgia decide which symbol should represent them. I believe it can be the beginning of a healing process.
Black leaders from around Georgia have called on the legislature to reject the governor's proposal, saying it would be too divisive. For NPR News, I'm Susanna Capoluto in Atlanta.
The New York City Council has approved a measure that would ban the use of cell phones at public performances. The council voted 38-5 to override a veto by Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who says the ban is unenforceable. The measure makes it a violation to use a cell phone at concerts, movies, plays, museums, libraries, and galleries. Violators would be subject to a $50 fine. The NASDAQ lost 16 points today to close at 1278. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing innovative approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America. On the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to talk about the possible consequences of a war with Iraq and the current threat of terrorism with journalist Ahmed Rashid. He's been covering militant Islam since the late 80s. His book Taliban was published in 2000 and became a number one bestseller after September 11th. His latest book, Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia, has just been published in paperback. Rashid lives in Pakistan and reports from his country as well as Afghanistan and Central Asia for the Far Eastern Economic Review and the London Daily Telegraph. He's also written pieces for the Wall Street Journal. Last month, Rashid was in Afghanistan. He's currently visiting the United States. I recorded an interview with him yesterday, shortly after Colin Powell announced the appearance of the new Bin Laden tape. Have you heard any inside information about what al-Qaeda is planning next?
No, not really. But I think it's long been expected, at least for the last 6 months or so. I mean, I was in Kabul a couple of weeks ago, and there was a lot of rumor there that there's going to be a big hit in the United States or in Europe. The Afghan intelligence was saying that's what they were picking up, and some of the peacekeeping troops and the American officers there were saying the same thing. There has been renewed activity on the Pakistan-Afghanistan border with al-Qaeda and Taliban coming in and hitting at American bases. And a lot of the propaganda that's been released there has been actually about Iraq and, you know, launching a jihad against American forces in Afghanistan, but also about that the Americans are about to invade the Middle East and capture the whole of the Middle East and that kind of thing. So it's pretty apparent that they want to do something that will coincide with possibly an American attack on Iraq.
So in some circles, this is being pitched as an American invasion of the Middle East.
Certainly. Certainly the groups like al-Qaeda and all are certainly talking about it. I mean, they see this not just as a question of changing the regime in Iraq, but actually occupying Arab land and then occupying the whole Middle East.
Well, I've been really anxious to talk with you because I'm very interested in what you're hearing and what you're thinking now. Let's start with your just general reactions. Do you think, based on your knowledge of that part of the world, do you think we should be going to war against Iraq to overthrow Saddam Hussein?
I think, you know, Saddam has to go, but I don't think the U.S. should be going to war, and certainly not in the way that it's been worked out for the last 3 or 4 months. I think to go to war without an international consensus, without the much more pressure to be placed through the UN inspectors and the inspecting regime and through the United Nations Security Council, I think to go to war is going to be extremely divisive in the West and is going to sharpen the conflict between the Muslim world and the United States.
Why do you think that Saddam has to go?
Well, certainly I think Saddam has to go. I mean, you know, but I think there were other ways to do it. I think if this administration 6 months ago had gone step by step with the kind of pressures, perhaps moving troops to the Gulf, pressures through the UN, try to build an international consensus with the Arab states, with the European powers. For example, I mean, the kind of speech we heard from Colin Powell a few days ago in the UN Security Council, I mean, to my mind, that speech should have been given 3 months ago, not, you know, right on the edge of war. So you needed, you know, you needed a consistent, a proper strategy where the US was not seen by the rest of the world as going it alone, as doing things arrogantly, but wanting to do things in consensus with everyone else.
How much of a threat do you think Iraq's weapons of mass destruction are?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, the fact is that they haven't, Iraq's has never targeted the United States. It has certainly targeted, you know, Middle Eastern countries. But I don't think Iraq would still target the United States even now. I don't believe Iraq has handed over chemical weapons to al-Qaeda the way that Colin Powell has asserted. I think some al-Qaeda members may be hiding out in Iraq. But I think Saddam Hussein's whole strategy, if we see, go back to 1991, has been always to try and target Israel, to bring Israel into the war so that he can then turn around to his Arab brothers and say, look, Israel is now attacking an Arab country, come and join me. I think that is what his tactics this time are going to be. I don't think he has the kind of global sort of megalomania like al-Qaeda have, you know, that they want to strike in Manhattan or something.
So are you suggesting that you think Saddam Hussein would attack Israel with the intention of dragging Israel into the war so that Iraq can say, look, Israel is fighting us, and now we have to all go to war against Israel?
Yeah, I think that is one of the huge dangers in this conflict. I think one of the biggest dangers would be if Israel joins the conflict. And we really have not had anything from this administration to explain if they are trying to keep Israel out of the conflict. I think Israel, last time, if you remember, Scud missiles fell on Israel. This time, God forbid, you may have chemical or biological missiles falling on Israel. But Israel has to keep out of the war, because if Israel gets involved in the war, I think it will become a much bigger and bloodier affair.
You know, I know the Bush administration wants Israel to stay out of the war, and it seems like, well, here's the United States on the verge of invading Iraq because of the potential threat of weapons of mass destruction. And is it a lot to ask of a country to do nothing if it's actually attacked with weapons of mass destruction?
I agree with you, Terry, but, you know, Israel showed patience in 91 when they were attacked by Scuds, and those Scuds could also have been carrying chemical and biological weapons.
But they weren't.
I mean, I agree with you. But I think the aftermath of a war with Iraq is going to be extraordinarily dangerous anyway. And if Israel does get involved, I think it's going to be even more dangerous with the Arab regimes up in arms, with protests in the streets against the Arab regimes, with an escalation of the Palestinian issue. I think it's critical that the U.S. does mount pressure on Israel to keep out, or tries to protect Israel in some form or the other.
Colin Powell, in his presentation to the Security Council, said that the militant Islamist group in northern Iraq, Ansar al-Islam, is tied in with al-Qaeda. What do you know about that group?
Ansar al-Islam is a Kurdish group. We should remember that. It's the Islamic fringe, if you like, of the mainstream Kurdish nationalist movement. There's always been a small Islamic fringe. Now it is certainly, I think, it's being funded and has been supported by al-Qaeda. But it is very, very small. It's a couple of hundred people, basically. They've carried out some terrible acts, atrocious acts, against fellow Kurds. But, you know, they're not in a position to be a fighting force for Saddam or to really affect the battlefield. I mean, the point is that, you know, these people can probably be eliminated. They will be eliminated, I'm sure, very quickly on in any kind of American invasion. I think there are dozens of groups like this scattered around the Muslim world now, which have at some point been funded by al-Qaeda, to which also al-Qaeda militants have fled after the war in Afghanistan. So, I mean, there's nothing more, in my opinion, there's nothing more in than Ansarul Islam than there is in many groups in Pakistan, in Iran, in the Far East, who are all involved in extremist acts and acts of terrorism.
Is there any connection, as far as you know, between this radical Islamist group, Ansar al-Islam, and Saddam Hussein?
Yes, I think there is. I mean, certainly there are connections. But I think Ansar al-Islam is too small to be any kind of effective fighting force for Saddam Hussein in a conflict with the United States. I mean, they're made up of a few hundred people. They control a very small area. I think they would be immediately bombed or they would be immediately surrounded by other Kurdish fighters. It was an attempt by him to create a kind of Islamic bloc within the Kurdish movements, which would split and divide the Kurdish movement. And really, they haven't even succeeded in doing that effectively, because the kind of extremism that they've espoused is very unpopular in the Kurdish region.
But if this group is linked both to al-Qaeda and to Saddam Hussein, does that effectively create some kind of link between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda?
No, I mean, Ansar al-Islam is one of the many, many groups which have been funded by al-Qaeda. It's one of the many groups in the world which, since the defeat of al-Qaeda and the Taliban in Afghanistan, has received and hosted al-Qaeda members. But, you know, al-Qaeda has gone into many countries and been hosted by many countries. I mean, even hosted by intelligence agencies of many countries which are ostensibly with the Americans. I mean, we can take the example of Yemen, of Iran, and even to some extent of Pakistan. Many Muslim countries are hosting al-Qaeda, willingly or unwillingly. Saddam is just one of them, I think. I mean, you know, if this is a raison d'etre to go after Saddam, then you might as well go after another half a dozen countries who are doing much the same kind of thing.
So you're saying that this link that Colin Powell is using as a justification for war isn't really significant?
I don't think the al-Qaeda link is really significant. I think the al-Qaeda link is certainly there. I don't think Saddam would be about to hand over chemical weapons to them. I think he's given sanctuary to some of the al-Qaeda people fleeing Afghanistan, like many other Muslim countries have given sanctuary to al-Qaeda, which the United States knows well about. And I think this Ansar group is not so much al-Qaeda. It's a fringe Kurdish group which has connections to al-Qaeda, but it's not in a position to really affect the strategic balance in the Middle East or any kind of strategic balance in a war between America and Iraq. I think the linkages with al-Qaeda are very tenuous. I mean, a lot of countries, unfortunately, have developed links with al-Qaeda since 9/11. And Iraq is no better or no worse than others. I think where Colin Powell was successful in his description was, of course, explaining the failure of Iraq to deliver on its chemical and biological weapon systems. I think the linkage with al-Qaeda is far more doubtful.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ahmed Rashid, and he reports from Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia for the Far Eastern Economic Review and the London Daily Telegraph. He's the author of the bestseller Taliban, and his latest book, Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia, has just come out in paperback. Let's take a break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ahmed Rashid, and his latest book, Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia, has just come out in paperback. A lot of people are speculating, you know, does the Bush administration have a hidden agenda? Is the agenda something than just overthrowing Saddam Hussein because he poses a threat with weapons of mass destruction? From your reading of the situation, do you see a hidden agenda? Do you think oil is the real agenda?
No, I mean, oil is very important. There's no doubt about it. I mean, but I don't think, you know, the U.S. is doing this whole thing because of oil. I think, you know, There's been a long-running standoff between the Bush family and Saddam Hussein. I think there's a very ideological group of officials at the top end of the administration who are very supportive of Israel and are very keen to try and reshape the Middle East in the way that they see it. They're not going to allow anything to come in their way. So, I mean, I think oil is a very important factor. I mean, in fact, one of the problems I have with this, in the post-Saddam era, how is the next Iraqi government, which will be installed by the Americans, how is that going to deal with the oil business? Who's going to get the contracts? The point is that Saddam has signed contracts with the Russians, the Chinese, the Europeans, with all sorts of major countries and major oil companies. Who gets now to, you know, will those contracts be honored? Who gets the benefits of Iraq's oil? And I think there's a lot of suspicion right now that, you know, is this just going to be a kind of, you know, that the American general who's running Iraq or the Iraqi exiles who are installed by the Americans are going to hand out contracts to American companies? I don't think, you know, that'll be the case. That would be very naive if something like that happens. But certainly it's an issue that has not been discussed, that the Bush administration has not done anything to give some kind of sense of security to other major countries who have got investments or contracts in Iraq.
Are there other dangers related to terrorism or economic dangers that you think the Bush administration isn't prepared for, or at least hasn't told us to be prepared for?
Well, I think the main thing which is completely missing from the administration's debate and discussion and information about this issue is the post-Saddam Iraq. What we don't know, I mean, where is the kind of discussion as to what kind of Iraq this administration wants? I mean, do you think the Arabs or the Iraqis are going to be satisfied with a bunch of Iraqi exiles being flown into Baghdad by the CIA and then being told, well, this is your new government? The point is that there has been no coalition building, not just for the war, but for the post-war scenario, especially with Iraq's neighbors. The problem is that all of Iraq's neighbors have potential candidates to be the next ruler in Baghdad. They all want their proxies to be there. The Turks, the Saudis, the Syrians, the Israelis, the Gulf Arabs, they all want a particular kind of government, preferably their kind of government in Baghdad. Now, they're not going to necessarily accept what the U.S. is going to set up there. What the U.S. really needed to do was, apart from, you know, the whole discussion today is just about whether so-and-so country is giving the Americans bases or military flights or whatever, what real discussion needs to take place is some kind of consensus building on post-Saddam, and would there, you know, like in Afghanistan, would there be a consensus government, meaning would the international community, perhaps through a UN Security Council resolution, give support to a new government in Iraq, which would be uncontestable? We don't see that at all.
The Bush administration is hoping that the Iraqis will welcome American troops as liberators. What do you think are the odds of that?
I think it's a presumption. This is a dictatorship. It's been one of the most awful and bloodiest dictatorships that the world has ever seen. There's no way that anybody has any idea what the Iraqi people are thinking. Yes, we know in 91 that thousands of troops laid down their arms. That could well happen again. But an attack on Baghdad and on the major urban centers of Iraq, would that lead to resistance from diehard supporters of Saddam? Could that prolong the war? Could they hide Saddam? I mean, I just don't think we know enough about the mood amongst the Iraqi people as to whether they'd fight or not.
Let's talk a little bit about your country, Pakistan. What are the risks or the benefits to Pakistan if the United States leads an invasion of Iraq?
Well, Pakistan, like the rest of the Muslim world, I mean, there could be... it's a very unpredictable situation. We just don't know how the fundamentalist parties will react. And we should remember that in Pakistan now, we had these elections in October, which were very heavily rigged by the military, who facilitated the victory of a fundamentalist alliance in two of the country's four provinces. it's very unpredictable as to what they will do, especially in those two provinces that they're now governing. Certainly we will see street demonstrations and that kind of thing. We may well see even acts of violence and terrorism by some of the extremist groups against Western targets. I think at the moment now there's a very heightened sense of alert in Pakistan against acts of terrorism. But it remains very unpredictable.
Is everybody in Pakistan talking about the possibility of war? Is that on the forefront of everybody's minds?
It's a complete preoccupation for several reasons. The first thing is that in 91, we suffered a horrendous economic downturn because, the whole region was locked up. And if there's a second war, there'll be no planes, there'll be no ships, there'll be no trade, there'll be no exports. Pakistan is heavily dependent on Gulf oil. Ships will not want to come to Karachi. So there's enormous economic fear. There's enormous political fear about what the fundamentalists will do, what the repercussions will be. The post-war scenario also offers, a lot of hesitancy and doubt for many Pakistanis. So there is enormous. And one thing which has kind of gripped the press there at the moment is this whole idea of many countries in the Muslim world saying, well, who's next? The Iranians are saying, well, after Iraq is going to be Iran. And many Pakistanis are saying, well, with Pakistan's nuclear program and Pakistan still, not fully cooperating with on the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, maybe Pakistan is next. And so there's a lot of this kind of speculation also going on.
And you're saying that that's one of the problems of the preemptive strike.
Well, exactly. I mean, I think this preemptive policy of the United States now, it has, one thing about the U.S. and during the Cold War was that, the U.S. and the Soviet Union, no matter how acute the tensions were, that, they were predictable powers. The U.S. in the last 10 years, since the end of the Cold War, as the sole superpower in the world, has been a predictable power. I mean, what it has done or not done under the two Clinton administrations was fairly predictable. I think where this whole doctrine of preemption brings you to is in creating enormous instability and unpredictability. And I think, everyone from the stock markets to politicians and intellectuals and educators, people are very concerned about this. I think in America they're very concerned about this, which is why, we've been seeing these demonstrations against the war in America.
Journalist Ahmed Rashid will be back in the second half of the show. His latest book, Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia, has just been published in paperback. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Harmony Books, a member of the Crown Publishing Group, a division of Random House Incorporated, publishers of 10 Poems to Open Your Heart by Roger Husden. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
If the U.S. goes to war with Iraq and ousts Saddam Hussein, we'll face rebuilding Iraq in the aftermath. Coming up, are we succeeding in rebuilding Afghanistan and creating a democracy there? We continue our conversation with journalist Ahmed Rashid. He was in Afghanistan last month. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with journalist Ahmed Rashid. He's the author of the bestseller Taliban. His latest book, Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia, has just been published in paperback. Rashid covers Afghanistan, Central Asia, and his country, Pakistan, for the Far Eastern Economic Review and the London Daily Telegraph. If we attack Iraq, we will also be responsible for rebuilding Iraq. We've taken on that responsibility with Afghanistan. You spent part of January in Afghanistan. Let's talk a little bit about your trip there and what you saw and how well the United States is succeeding in trying to rebuild Afghanistan. Let's start with Kabul. What kind of shape is Kabul in physically?
Well, Kabul is definitely, in many ways, a better shape. About a million, you know, the population has gone up from about 3 million to 4 million just in the last year because about a million refugees have come into Kabul and settled there. So there is extraordinary pressure on the infrastructure. Now, I mean, there's no electricity in most of the city. The center of Kabul has a little bit of electricity at night. And don't forget, we're talking about freezing temperatures, below freezing temperatures here with snow on the ground. There's enormous pressure on water, on electricity, on fuel, on power, on everything. On the other hand, I mean, there are now, the city is looking much fresher. Women are going about unveiled. Kabulis are back to work in all sorts of things. There's an enormous hustle and bustle in the bazaar. The major urban centers, you know, are showing a very dramatic improvement and change. Schools are open. Hospitals are open. Government offices are open. And there's a lot of cultural activity, which, of course, is terribly important to restore civic life after the Taliban, who had destroyed all culture, you know, music recitals, concerts, things like that.
In a recent report, you wrote, despite pledges of help for President Karzai, Russia is arming one warlord and Iran another. India and Pakistan are continuing their long rivalry and secretly backing different claimants to power, while the Central Asian republics are backing their ethnic allies. It sounds like chaos.
Well, unfortunately, I think, you know, the bottom line has been that for the last year, since the war ended, the reconstruction of Afghanistan has not taken place. The money for reconstruction has not been delivered. And the lead role that was expected of the United States in that process has not happened. Now, what that has led to, of course, is that the central government has not been able to expand its authority into the provinces to curb the power of the warlords, to try and disarm and demobilize these warlord armies. And in this kind of vacuum, a lot of the neighbors who were interfering in Afghanistan before have made a comeback. And they're all, you know, like they were before. I mean, if we remember in the 90s, one of the major causes for the Afghan conflict was the fact that all the neighbors were involved in backing either the Taliban or the opposition to the Taliban. And then they kind of laid off, you know, after 9/11. But now they've seen that the Americans, some of them are judging perhaps the Americans are not serious about reconstruction. The Americans may leave in a hurry. So we better get back and create our spheres of influence, which is what they're doing.
Do you think that the Karzai government is in trouble? Do you think it's possible it will be overthrown?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think the point is that the government is still supported by 90% of the people. Now, and the warlords who are opposed to the government are not defying the government or Karzai. I mean, they may not be implementing what he orders to be done, but they're not defying him. There's no challenge to Kabul at the moment. But the fact is that you cannot have a kind of sustained low-level kind of anarchic situation. And you have to strengthen the center. You've got to help the center rebuild the country, build up road and communications and electricity and agriculture and, you know, all the necessary things. And it really hasn't happened. And I think there's enormous frustration amongst many Afghans. But that is still not, I think, going to turn them against Karzai, because Afghans know that if, you know, I spoke to many people on the street, and the kind of common assumption was, well, he's better than anyone else. If anyone can deliver international aid and assistance, he can do it. Certainly nobody else can. So there's still a belief in him, which I think, you know, is still strong.
Did you get a sense of whether the popular sentiment is that America is fulfilling its promise to help Afghanistan rebuild?
No, I mean, the popular sentiment is very frustrated with the Americans, with the United Nations, and with all the donors. The fact is that a year ago, $4.5 billion was pledged to Afghanistan in reconstruction. None of that really started last year. Only now are we in March and April, something like, you know, $1 billion will be coming in for road construction, which is critical to kind of relink the country. There will be money for agriculture. There will be some money for demobilization. But now, of course, the big fear is, you know, that even if the money comes in a year and a half late, it would still do incredibly good things, I think, and it wouldn't be too late. But the real fear is this effort, which now the Americans and the donor community seem to have launched for this spring, will that be completely overshadowed by Iraq? Will Iraq now distract from Afghanistan? And that's the fear of President Karzai and other leaders.
If you look at Afghanistan and see how things are going there in the light of the bombing of Afghanistan, what lessons do you think, or what questions do you think we might take away and apply to the future of Iraq if the United States attacks Iraq?
Well, I think, you know, Afghanistan, first of all, the choice of Karzai to head the interim government right after the war January 2001, this was a choice where all the Afghans, you know, sent their representatives to Bonn. There was an agreement which was endorsed by the entire international community, even enemies of the United States, such as Iran, Korea. I mean, they endorsed Karzai. We don't see any of that kind of process happening in the post-Saddam Iraq. I think the other big problem has been I had hoped, certainly at the end of the war in Afghanistan, that the Americans would understand that they needed to help rebuild Afghanistan, not just for the sake of the Afghans, but as a kind of model for the whole of the Islamic world, to show the Islamic world that, look, we can bomb you, but we can also help rebuild you. But unfortunately, that hasn't happened. And there's an enormous, I think, amount of mistrust in the Arab world that, well, what will the Americans do? They'll come in, they'll bomb Baghdad, they'll kill Saddam, and then they'll, you know, leave a kind of chaotic situation in Iraq and then get up and just take a back seat, as they've done in Afghanistan. So the American record, unfortunately, in Afghanistan as far as reconstruction and rebuilding has not been good.
Is there a feeling in Afghanistan among people you spoke to that the United States' bigger concern now is Iraq, therefore Afghanistan has kind of dropped in its level of priority?
Well, certainly, you know, I spent a lot of time with President Karzai, and it is about one of the top issues on his mind right now. He is being courted. President Bush has invited him to Washington at the end of February. And clearly, American officials are trying to allay his fears and suspicions that the Americans are about to dump Afghanistan or not focus on it anymore. But certainly, you know, it remains an overriding concern. Because, you see, it's not just the Americans. I mean, if the Americans stop paying attention to Afghanistan as far as reconstruction is concerned, it really means that the rest of the international community will also drop by the wayside. It's not that the Europeans or the Japanese or the Arabs, who are all major donors to Afghanistan, are going to continue. They'll just feel, well, if the U.S. is not interested, this is not important.
My guest is journalist Ahmed Rashid. His latest book is called Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. He's also the author of the bestseller Taliban. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Pakistani-based journalist Ahmed Rashid. He's the author of the bestseller Taliban, and his latest book, Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia, has just come out in paperback. Do you have any idea where the Taliban who fled Afghanistan are now?
almost the entire Taliban leadership, which is still alive, is sitting in Pakistan. It's been given sanctuary there by the military government. The intelligence services have been working very closely with the Taliban, helping out their families, settling them down. And some of these Taliban have reorganized and are now crossing the border back into Afghanistan and attacking U.S. forces there.
But Pakistan is officially supporting President Karzai and has cooperated with the United States in handing over al-Qaeda operatives. So how can they be doing both at the same time, cooperating in the war on terrorism and at the same time harboring the Taliban?
Well, I think, you know, this is an issue that is creating growing concern in Washington and amongst many Pakistanis. President Musharraf is running a military regime there. He basically gets to do what he likes, and he does not take public opinion in. I think there was a lot of support for the U-turn he did after 9/11 towards dumping Pakistani support for the Taliban and siding with the U.S. and joining the coalition against terrorism. Now he seems to be doing a U-turn upon a U-turn. And there's several reasons for this, I think. I mean, I think one thing is that the intelligence services and a section of the military, which are highly influenced by the Taliban-style ideas of Islamic fundamentalism, have really not been purged by the general. In fact, they've been strengthened to some extent. So you have an ideological affinity there with the Taliban. The other thing that Pakistan is very wary about is the growing political and economic presence of India in Afghanistan and the influence that India has. I mean, the last thing Pakistan wants to face is a kind of two-front situation where it has India on the west and the east, as it were.
What's one of the most interesting and surprising things that you saw on your trip to Afghanistan?
Well, I still think, you know, it's extraordinary enthusiasm of the people and the extraordinary patience of the people. Although little, their lives have not changed all that much in the last 1 year, they are still very expectant. I think the other thing has been the remarkable change in what women are doing. I mean, you know, women are back to work, children are back to school. I mean, you know, after visiting Afghanistan so many times and seeing all the schools shut up, you know, to see children carrying satchels full of books, you know, on the street in sort of raggedy uniforms is really one of the most beautiful sights. I mean, it really makes you want to just sit, you know, stand there and cry, basically, because for years and years and years, that was not a sight you saw. And I mean, I visited friends, you know, where, I mean, you know, 3 months, 6 months down the road, where mothers say goodbye to their children in the morning as they go to school, and the mothers are crying because they can't believe that it's still, you know, that actually our children are being able to go to school. So there are advances that have taken place there which are still very, very moving.
In NATO now, one of the big issues is Turkey, and the United States wish to provide military aid to Turkey, military assistance to Turkey if Turkey is attacked during a war with Iraq. That was vetoed. What do you see happening within the NATO alliance now?
Well, first of all, let me just say I think Turkey is in a terribly difficult position.
Let's talk about that a little bit.
You've just had an election in Turkey. You've got an Islamic government in power, which the Turkish military, which has always intervened in Turkey, has been very wary of. But I think this Islamic government has acted very moderately and very wisely in not trying to rock the boat too much at home. But it still has a very difficult agenda at home, placating the military, placating. And then it's been lumped with this whole foreign policy issue of, you know, the war with Iraq. And clearly the population of Turkey is very much against any war with Iraq because of the economic dislocation is going to be so enormous, as it was for Turkey in the first Gulf War. The Turks are really in a very, very difficult position. And I think, you know, the U.S. should be kind of ultra grateful for any even the minimum kind of support and basing rights, etc., that they might be giving the U.S. forces. The issue in NATO, I think, has certainly become very divisive. There is no, you know, the the point is that the Germans, the French, they're facing enormous pressure from their own populations. I mean, if you look at the polls in Europe, I mean, I think more than 50% of Europeans oppose a war, generally, broadly speaking. These governments in Europe, which are like standing up to the United States right now, face enormous public pressure. And, you know, I mean, they could their own political futures could well be on the line. And I think this is the extent to which this policy with Iraq has, unfortunately, become. Many regimes' lives are at stake.
Do you think that the United States has a dependable ally in Turkey now?
Well, I think it still has to be tested. I mean, for Turkey, too, I mean, this is the first time that you have an Islamic government, an Islamic party in power, which has got a kind of blessing from the military and which now has to work with the Western alliance, with NATO, and also pursue its agenda to try and join the European common market. Now, you know, all this puts a lot of burden on Turkey and this new government.
Ahmed Rashid, your latest book, Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia, has just come out in paperback. So I want to talk with you a little bit about Central Asia and how that figures in to the war scenario now. And by the way, by Central Asia, you're talking about Turkmenistan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan. You say that the Bush administration has seemed to take the attitude that Central Asia is little more than a convenient base from which the U.S. can stage its war on terrorism. What? How do you think? And I know that you think that might backfire, that's not a good strategy and it might backfire. What kind of problems do you see ahead if the Bush administration continues with that strategy?
Well, I think, again, you know, like in Afghanistan, there was enormous expectancy amongst people in Central Asia that once the Afghan war was over, the Americans would develop a kind of broad-based strategy here, which would nudge and cajole and pressure and persuade through a mixture of carrot and stick. These regimes, very dictatorial, authoritarian regimes, to open up a bit, to carry out some economic reform, political reform, allow political parties to exist, you know, encourage some kind of civil society and middle class to emerge. But in fact, none of that has happened. The U.S. has now three bases in three countries, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan. It has done very little. You know, apart from making some rhetorical noises, it has done very little to encourage democracy or reform or greater freedoms there. And in fact, what we've seen in the last 15 months since 9/11 is that all these regimes have in fact stepped up repression. They have used the new alliance with the United States as a means to kind of make themselves legitimate. And they have stepped up repression against, you know, dissident groups, against political parties, against, you know, human rights groups, against the media. The amount of journalists that are in jail right now in Central Asia due to this kind of crackdown by the regimes was not there before. So rather than improving the situation, we are seeing a new wave of repression, which is going on, if you like, on the back of this kind of new strategic alliance with the United States.
What impact do you think that repression is going to have on the militant Islamist groups within Central Asia?
Well, you know, I think this, you know, the 9/11 was a huge opportunity for the United States simply because anti-Americanism was not prevalent in Central Asia at all. It was perhaps one of the few regions in the Muslim world where there was no anti-Americanism, simply because the people there had no experience of America. They had no knowledge of America culture or American power or anything like that. Now, these Islamic movements have always been very fringe movements. I mean, they have largely been in exile, living in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, or other Central Asian states. They have always had a minimum of support, but clearly the fact that, you know, these states and these regimes have become more authoritarian may well increase support for Islamic fundamentalism, because whatever you don't have in Central Asia, you don't have a democratic secular opposition. These regimes have not allowed democratic parties to exist, which means that there's a political vacuum there, and that vacuum could well increasingly be filled by militant fundamentalists.
Who would be very anti-American?
Who would be very anti-American, who would want to topple the regimes, who would want to link, their movements with the aim of overthrowing the regimes and also, you know, link themselves up with Al-Qaeda and other such groups.
My guest is journalist Ahmed Rashid. His latest book is Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. He's also the author of the bestseller Taliban. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Ahmed Rashid. He's based in Pakistan. He reports on Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia for the Far Eastern Economic Review and the London Daily Telegraph. You regularly travel through parts of the world where terrorism is an everyday occurrence. What's it like to be in the United States during a high alert?
It's very strange. As you can imagine, I'm on this book tour and I've been to a dozen cities and I'm searched about four times more than anyone else at the airports. And it seems very strange. I mean, to have to go. I mean, I've been very patient. I haven't objected. But the way I look, and I suppose, and this and that, my name and everything, you know, my ticket is instantly marked with, I don't know, all sorts of scratches and numbers, which means that every person who glances at my boarding pass has to search me about three times over. So it's quite nerve-wracking and very, very strange.
And do you feel tolerant of that? Like, oh, well, I understand, you know, it's unfortunate, but I understand why they're doing it. Or are you angry about that and feel like...
No, I'm tolerant about it. I mean, I do understand why they're doing it. You know, I just wish there was a way that my publishers could have, in fact, sent out a message saying, you know, he's okay and he's with Penguin and you don't have to search him three times.
Right. He's the guy we're inviting here to help explain what's happening.
Exactly. You know.
I hate to ask you to speculate and look into a crystal ball on all of that, but I'd really like to know what your best guess is about what happens next.
Well, Terry, I think in the best case scenario, which is that America invades Iraq, Saddam is toppled, the war is short, Saddam is killed, you will then have the whole process of reconstructing Iraq. And I think that is going to be incredibly complicated. And I really don't know whether this administration has the patience, has the humility, has the conciliatory kind of politics that will be needed to really build a government of consensus in Iraq, which could actually stabilize Iraq. And then you will be faced with upsurges in the Muslim world and most critically, the Palestinian-Israeli problem. And will this administration be willing to put pressure on Israel to meet the Palestinians halfway? I doubt it very much. Very difficult times are up ahead.
Wait a minute, that was your best case scenario, right?
That is my best case scenario.
Yeah, well,
exactly.
What's the not best case scenario? What if it's not a short war?
I think, you know, if it's not a short war and the war goes on even for, say, 6 to 8 weeks, for example, which in these days and with this kind of technology and all for America is a long war, I think we would see much greater acts of terrorism worldwide by Islamic groups, attacks against American targets, right across the world, in Europe, in America. And I think there would be a reaction in the street. I mean, that would allow a street reaction to build up. And then you would have real problems faced by many of these regimes, which are Western allies in the Muslim world.
Do you think there's any chance that this war won't happen?
No, I think the administration is absolutely determined to have a war, come what may. And clearly the kind of preparations that are going on now have been quite extraordinary and really, I mean, seem to be pitting us, you know, right at the edge there of a war.
Well, Ahmed Rashid, I wish you safe travels, and I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much indeed.
Journalist Ahmed Rashid covers Afghanistan, Central Asia, and his country, Pakistan, for the Far Eastern Economic Review and the London Daily Telegraph. His latest book, Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia, has just been published in paperback. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. I just recorded an interview with the blues singer and guitarist Alvin Youngblood Hart. We'll hear it sometime soon. In the meantime, here's a song from his latest CD, Down in the Alley. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Cinema Therapy for Lovers, The Couple's Guide to Finding Happiness One Movie at a Time, by Nancy Pesky and Beverly West. This is NPR, National Public Radio. As we face the likelihood of war with Iraq, we also face a nuclear crisis with North Korea. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Nicholas Kristof, a columnist for the New York Times. He's covered North and South Korea off and on since 1986. He served as the Times bureau chief in Hong Kong, Beijing, and Tokyo. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.